Welcome, everyone.
And approval on the January 15th and 16th, 2014 fact-finding trip. We held off on rendering a decision on that pending the discussion that the station was going to be giving on the spent fuel pool inventory management. And given that, and the fact that they have, their plans show an acceleration of the reduction of the spent fuel inventory to a level of 736 old bundles in each pool now by the year 2016, we felt that appears to be reasonable. I talked with Dr. Peterson. And just for the record, this is what is proposed to be the conclusion. This is what is proposed to be the conclusion for our for that particular topic.
Yeah. Could you read it?
I will read it into the record then. The conclusion is that PG&E's current plans for accelerating the reduction of its spent fuel inventory to a level of 736 old bundles in each pool by 2016 appear to be reasonable. And that's it.
And then we'll continue, of course, to follow up.
Then, of course, then we'll, just as we've been doing, we will always continue to follow up on this.
Actually, we usually add, we could add a sentence that would say, this is an important area, and the DCISC should continue to follow up.
Okay.
We sometimes put that also in our conclusion.
Okay, too. I will do that then.
Yeah.
With that, can I get approval for the...
It only deals with the next, we're in 2014 already, it only deals with the next two years.
That is correct. There's a drawdown during these next 2 years, that's right.
Certainly. The trajectory in the next 2 years is in what people would consider to be a correct direction.
On a very closely related matter, I last night had talked to Mr. Gary Harbour and also Mr. Strickland and make the following request. I think the official response from PG&E to the committee, second recommendation, would benefit from a supplemental response, which two major elements of consideration should be mentioned. One is that by the year 2016, the limit of the number of co-spent fuel bundle would be reached. Secondly, within the next 2 years, the company has made a
two and three quarters years away. I can't see how the schedule they've got here can be, they can get go any faster than that in the next 2.5 years. I just can't.
That's exactly
what,
right.
What we're wanting them to do is to plan about the years beyond that in a different way and tell us about that.
That is
fine. That's why that's fine for the next
right.
couple of years.
That's exactly right. That was the primary rationale for my conversation with Mr. Gary Harbour.
Yeah, good.
So that the official company response to the committee's second recommendation in our annual report would be more adequate.
Good.
Yes, Mr. Land, you've captured that well. Kerry Harper, for the record.
I am sorry. My apologies.
Oh, no problems. And yes.
Okay. I also have a second quick comment, which is that we also have one remaining other item of business from the agenda yesterday, which relates to approval of the one remaining item on the fact finding that relates to flexible response. And I'm curious if we have some guidance from PG&E that relates to any material that we should remove from that fact finding report that would be considered to be potentially proprietary.
Mr. Chairman, we would like additional time to review that information. We have not had an opportunity to take a look at everything. So we request a period of a week or so to continue our review, and then if we could communicate back to you, that would be good.
I think that that's fine. It's a small item in the overall fact-finding report. I believe we've already approved the remainder of the report for publication. So it's a sufficiently small item that maybe we can just carry it forward to the next public meeting agenda. That would be fine. Okay.
More important is that we had a discussion yesterday, extensive discussion, about where we think we're going, the committee's going, and we've told everybody where we think we're going or where we want to go, which is if serious proposals for load following emerge, we want to review them for their safety implications.
Since we're talking about the substance.
And there are short-term safety implications because if you load follow every day, you produce certain stresses and the like on what's out there that may be undesirably compromising of the safety. And then there's this much longer and bigger issue that isn't a...
We'll defer that item. We will need to take a vote after I think we have public comment, would be appropriate time, on approving the fact-finding report that includes the discussion about spent fuel inventory management. But I think this is actually the appropriate time now to move to the item of public comments. Because the two things. First of all, as counsel has pointed out, the committee members during our comment period have had some substantive discussion, so that's open for public comment. Also, any other matters not appearing on the agenda may be discussed at this time. The public may comment on matters that are on the agenda following the time that it is discussed. We have a time limit of 5 minutes, but as with yesterday, we're flexible. We have all day long, even though we expect our agenda will allow us to finish by lunchtime. So with that, I'd ask if there's any public comment.
Rochelle Becker, Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. In listening to you yesterday respond to several questions from the audience, from the public, and especially when Mr. Lamb said that we just can't do anything. We don't have, in your charter, you can't force the utility to do anything. And I certainly understand and have read your charter and have been there since the very beginning. But it doesn't mean that you can't have a list of recommendations for the committee, for the utility. And that's what the Energy Commission does in their IPER report. And I think it would be very helpful to the public in your annual report to have a list of recommendations that you've made each and every year so we can follow those up. The public can take those recommendations, whether you can act or not, whether the Energy Commission can do anything but recommend on certain points or not. The public can take those recommendations and educate our legislators with them, other oversight agencies with them, and say, you know, we have a consistent recommendation from both the Safety Committee, the Energy Commission, perhaps the Water Board, but it's a consistent state community joint resolution recommendations that we can bring to others to show that there's a concern that's not just in this agency or just in this agency, but is a concern across agencies. So I would like to recommend that you have a recommendation.
The discussion this morning, but I think we could also perhaps make that information more readily available and obvious, including perhaps having it posted in a special way on the website or something. We should take that into consideration.
Well, heck, I had a different take. Every year I've been here, the annual report has recommendations, but they're few in number. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's three. This last time it was only two. Because our threshold for deciding that something's a recommendation is of a character that produces only two or three. And I could take straight to heart the possibility that we could reevaluate that threshold and have a significantly larger number of them than the very few that we've had. There's no reason why we couldn't do that. We just haven't. It was a pattern that was here when I inherited. I inherited something that's been going on for years. But we don't have to behave that way necessarily. We could, because, you know, I bet it wouldn't be hard for us to go through and find about a dozen things that aren't as important as the two we just put in, but are not unimportant. Not of zero importance, if you know what I mean.
Point well taken. Any additional public comment? Very good. Thank you. At this point, we need to move on then to the next item. It's not on the agenda, but I believe we now want to conduct a vote on whether to approve the fact-finding report that includes discussion yesterday about spent fuel inventory management now that we have proposed text for the report. And could I ask for a motion to approve the fact-finding report?
I second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The report is approved as amended. Next, we move to informational items before the committee, and at this point, I'd like to again turn things over to Carrie Harbor to introduce our first speaker.
So again, I want to thank the members of the public who weren't here last night and for attending, and the ones that were here tonight for attending again today. So we appreciate the input, and right now we're going to go through a series of presentations from PG&E. So the first presentation...
I want to interrupt just to say something to the public. We had a longer agenda than what you see, but one...
And has a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering. Ken.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Carrie. Pleasure to be here. I know Dr. Peterson, we've talked many times. So I'd like to go over the office seismic safety action plan that we performed. We have a pretty robust plan in place, we believe, right now, and we'll go through the how we got there. So our agenda, I'd like the introduction. We've had some, I've had many discussions with Dr. Peterson on seismic safety, for office seismic safety. So we'll go through the status of the objectives that were brought out, our station improvements that we completed in 2013, and then our 2014 scheduled improvements for non-power block station. Okay, next slide. So things that we have committed, I won't read basically off the schedule, but what we've completed, we've done all the office equipment located within time critical response travel. What that is we worked with our operations group, and early second quarter last year we completed a evaluation of the routes that they used to safely shut the plant down in the event of emergency shutdown. What we reviewed was not the equipment for the plant, but any interaction that we may have from office equipment, storage shelves, things that are in hallways, aisleways, offices, that type of issue. That study, that evaluation was completed in May of last year, and all obstacles have either been restrained or have been removed. It was our preference to remove it in lieu of restraining them, so we removed most of those. Our operations group did a great job. We took on the as we do in the nuclear industry, we go out and we find out who does it better. So we went on a benchmarking trip. We went to Northern California. If you're going to look at seismic safety interaction, Northern California is the place you want to go. So we went. So and we'll get on to exactly places. We completed that in June of 2013. That benchmark trip was done. Then we developed our next process. Part of our action plan was to develop an action plan of how we step through it and generate a program policy, so how we can sustain this throughout the life of Diablo Canyon. And that was completed in August of 2013. We communicated that to our station population, roles, responsibilities, actions, expectations, a walk down of our facilities throughout the station. We use our supervisors as our to show ownership of the program for their areas. So we don't have one person who's individual to go walk down the station. We use the, as an example, an engineering supervisor would be responsible for the areas where his people are at. Common areas our facility maintenance group has, but we it provides more ownership throughout the station. And then we have a resolution program. If it's in the an area where it would fall under our corrective action program, such as control room within the power block, we track it through our corrective action programs. Otherwise, it goes to our facility maintenance building services report and request, and we track it that way. Facility maintenance does most of the upgrades outside of the power block. Okay. So to go back, so our benchmarking, our first stop was Dr. Peterson's office. We went and saw UC Berkeley. UC Berkeley was, first we went and we asked who does it well. We went various stations. We asked people. Internet does a good job at that. And these are the places that stood out for us. UC Berkeley, Dr. Peterson gave us a tour of the plant, showed us what they do, how they support their equipment, how they take care of their personnel. We appreciate that. Thank you very much. We went and then talked with Stanford. And at Stanford, we did offices, laboratories. We went and looked at what they do. Different thresholds, different programs, but we're just on a fact-finding. We did our corporate office at Beale Street, and 77 Beale Street and 245 Market. We, our corporation has a policy for it. We took that policy and we enhanced it. So now we're moving that up to our corporation. Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories, very interesting facility. It was they're very robust in their programs. We learned a lot. We learned a lot, and they like to send out big, thick reports, and we got a lot of those. And then Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, exceptional facility. Very. They have it. They took it down into a culture. Their personnel live it, and we learned a lot from Lawrence.
Let me say, there's a reason for that. If you put it in the culture from the beginning, it really does. It does work.
And they have a very strong culture there. We actually saw something that we asked about.
I mean, you mentioned that first. I just want to reinforce that. It's just really, go ahead.
And they fixed it right away. And it was brought up by the people in the shop. We went into their machine shop because we have, very similar to what we have.
Yeah.
And they responded and said, nope, that's not right, and they fixed it right away. That was exceptional. So we learned a lot from the laboratories.
By the way,
yes, sir.
If you went through the sort of design basis SSE exercise up there, we don't have it that because we're not an NRC licensee.
Right.
It'd be higher than out here.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's about, right. It's literally, and the problem is, and this is where these corridors and stuff matter, it's right on top of it. The vertical component is bigger than the horizontal layer. And that really causes a lot of havoc for furniture.
Mm-hmm.
I've learned this originally. And so they had to take it seriously or they were going to have injuries because there's 4,000 people on that hill and they're there all the time and there's going to be a lot of injuries.
You can't get down off the hill either.
That's true. Hmm. That's true.
The basically right through the center of our football stadium
is the Hayward Forum.
Right.
You're going to have at least a couple meters of displacement, and we're well overdue. I think the record is return frequency of about 140 years, and I think we're at like 180
now. Your lesson though was you said it about LBL. I'm responding because that's where I work.
Right.
That it is possible to make it part of the culture of the whole place, and
that's
it doesn't cost anything except just diligence. I mean, it doesn't cost money. It costs diligence, and it costs leadership, and it costs constant reinforcement, if you know
that's
what
correct.
I mean.
That's correct. And that's what we learned in our benchmarking. And as we took that to our station and we rolled that out, it is being more accepted.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
But by the way, it's a terrible nuisance. Every bookcase has these chains, and you can't get the book out. It's a nuisance.
Those chains and those plexiglass doors that close in the warehouses.
Which is why mm-hmm. there's a natural predilection to cut corners.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
And so, and that's very true. And talking with the people at Stanford and at Lawrence Livermore and at Lawrence Berkeley, they all had the same things. They, with the chains, the book racks, the tall cabinets. You're absolutely correct. So what we did is then after our benchmarking, we developed a policy for. Okay. So we communicated to our station. We had meetings. We met. We walked. We provided an electronic answer questions, and it's been embraced by our organization. As you walk through the station, and Dr. Peterson has been out there the last time, mm-hmm. it has changed since in the last year. We've done some upgrades to some locations. We relocate, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But you can see the difference in the station, and it's a notable difference. So we appreciate them doing it. It is definitely a safety focus for us, and we stay on top of it. Area walkdowns were performed by response.
May I interrupt, please?
Yes, sir.
Please elaborate a little bit more on the safety focus area, because this particular issue on office furniture falling on station personnel, at first glance, appears to me is an entirely OSHA issue. Somehow, we must have a linkage between protecting workers' safety to nuclear reactor safety. So please, you know, emphasize on the linkage.
That's easy.
Sure, and I can do that. So what we did is inside our power block for the plant, we worked with operations on our safe shutdown routes, right? The routes that the operators take to go to do the emergency equipment, we removed any storage cabinets or braced them if they had to stay in that area. So that kept the routes open. We looked at the control room, which is our shift manager. We looked at their furniture to ensure that he's an integral part of our plant, ensure that nothing falls on him. So we lowered all their equipment. They had 7-foot cabinets. We lowered them down to 5-foot and then restrained. Our briefing areas, our control room, is any office equipment in there is tied together, restrained, so it doesn't fall on operators if they have to make that response. So that's where we tie it into the plan.
Right, right, because my rationale asking the question is, if a piece of furniture falls on the shaft, it has different impact on a piece of furniture falling on a senior reactor operator in terms of nuclear plant safety, although, you know, both of them are equally valuable employee on the site.
You're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. So we started with the plant worked out, and now we ensure we have our hallways, our fire routes, our exit routes from buildings throughout all the outbuildings are open so that people can exit the building in the event of a seismic. And that's what was identified during walkdowns. Right. As we do upgrades throughout the station for office areas, we just relocated our engineering group to a different building. We went and made sure that we met all of our seismic requirements for office interaction, not just for the station.
Right. You see, the joke here is a piece of furniture falling on Professor Peterson is not as bad as falling on a student, because Professor Peterson had tenure.
wait a second. I didn't follow that.
just to say, for us, the key, besides injuries to personnel, the key was that the Lawrence Berkeley Lab is full of chemical and biological experiments that don't shut down the way an accelerator shuts down. The voltage, by the way, an accelerator doesn't have any residual anything. Once the voltage goes off, it's off. Mm-hmm. But we're full of that stuff, and that stuff has to be secured by people.
That's correct.
Okay, as opposed to an accelerator goes off, it's off. And that was a primary motivation going all the way back, to make sure that we protected people who then, in their labs, had to secure the stuff after, you know, during the strong motion.
That's correct.
Okay.
So, there's under probabilistic, if you look at probabilistic risk assessment, there's a way of thinking about these kinds of problems. An example is that the decay heat removal in a reactor is a safety-related function. Mm-hmm. You'll have a safety-related system for emergency decay heat removal, emergency core cooling system that has very high reliability. It meets, it's all housed in seismic category 1 buildings and everything. You would not choose to use that system for normal heat removal, because if you relied on it for that purpose and it was the only way to remove heat, the overall reliability is still insufficient. And as soon as you have a normal system, which has a sort of industrial level reliability, that is maybe 1 in 1,000, not 1 in 10 or 1,000 or 100,000 type of reliability, and the emergency system, at that point, having the lack of both of them becomes so unlikely that it falls outside of the sort of the range of things being credible. So in the case of seismic safety, the safety related systems are all designed such that they should have very high reliabilities, and in this case the humans are a critical element of that. But you don't have to house the humans in a seismic category 1 facility in order for the probability that they'll be able to be available to perform the work and to diagnose and correct problems to be sufficiently high. But if you've got clearly unsafe conditions, then you're in trouble. So with respect to office safety, it really is important to meet industrial standards, but it's not necessary to meet seismic category 1 type of standards. And the logic is that gives you sufficient confidence that they'll be available, that the residual risk can be managed, that the safety-related systems might not function as expected.
Right.
So at any rate, and at this point, what you've developed is, I think, an outstanding program that would meet the highest standards within industry for personnel safety. And I would hope, although it's not our charter, we don't give recommendations to other nuclear power plants, but to see this sort of approach more broadly adopted, it will fit closely into thinking about what is the necessary reliability of equipment for Flex.
Good.
Right? Because what Flex is doing, those pumps, generators, portable instruments, additional dosimetry, you know, all of this, these additional capabilities and the humans, is reducing residual risk. So Flex equipment, for example, it's not logical to need to locate it in a seismic class 1 type of facility. It needs to be one that meets industrial standards to very likely survive an earthquake, but not to the level, seismic category 1, which is, let's just say, above and beyond in terms of the confidence that if you were to have strong ground motion, it would survive, as an example. So this will feed into how also one thinks about the safety classification and treatment of Flex equipment, because it's a similar logic.
Correct. Okay, so we'll move on to the next slide, please. So tracking for resolution, items will be corrected using our, as I stated earlier, we have two systems, one for the power block, which would be tracked under our corrective action program. The second is our facilities management, which is for the outbuildings. We use those two programs.
That you said, you can't do it this way because of a security concern? Security access, to security barriers, security something.
As far as inside the power block, no, sir.
Yeah, I wouldn't have.
No, sir. We didn't. We did not. We did not see that.
You didn't see anything like that.
No. No. Not that I'm aware of. And I'm the owner of this, so not that I'm aware of. No.
Okay.
Okay. And then if we go to the next slide, completion 2013 completions. We upgraded our shift manager's office. The furniture there, there was some concern about it falling over, so we took care of our shift manager. They're kind of important. No, they're okay. We're very important. Admin and training facilities. We upgraded our simulator building. There was some equipment and office furniture in there that we removed and put in. Went through the part of the program, but lowered the cabinets, made sure they had doors on, that type of issues to protect that. We have a new outage control center. We removed it from inside the power block. It was on our 119 mm-hmm. level between the units. It's now in the admin building on the fifth floor. New furniture, new equipment.
Saw that.
A good facility. We updated the TSC OSC, which is our emergency response facilities on the station. By upgrading that, we had cabinets, desks, equipment in there that wasn't up to our standards. So we replaced all the cabinets. We put doors on everything. We anchored them down, put new furniture, new equipment throughout that building. That would fall under our critical equipment. Our new plant access facility, which is our security building, meets our requirements. Engineering was in, they were housed in our building 201 and 202, which were the two oldest buildings on station. We have relocated our engineering group from those two buildings to the second floor of our main warehouse. Work office for 141 engineers up there, all with the upgraded seismic requirements, cabinets, and to give them a better place.
And you're going to take down 201, 202?
That is correct. Our plan is to remove those two buildings. And to be honest, this helped drive...
Those aren't buildings, those are trailers, right?
No, sir, those are actually... Those are actually, okay.
Those are actually...
They look like trailers.
Which buildings they are.
They're, like I said, they're the first two buildings on the station.
Workforce morale must have gone up a notch.
Workforce morale did change quite a bit, that's correct. And so then, if we go on next slide, what we're going to do for 2014 is we're going to remove building 201, 202. We'll remove that to better facilities, better equipment inside that, because it's an office inside the power block. And then the old security building, building 105, is we're updating that building to house our security and our security maintenance groups, and that'll take into account all of the office seismic upgrades that we want to maintain at the station. So that'll be done this year also.
So one other item is that one also wants to make sure that employees take these ideas home with them.
Yes.
And because the last thing you need is somebody's a beeper going off from underneath the bookcase, right, where they're trapped. So what could you comment on what effort there is to try to encourage employees to take these practices home with them and to think about them in their own homes and living spaces as
Certainly.
Well?
Through our communications, whether it's the five-minute safety meeting or the eConnect or just a morning brief, we always, whatever the safety focus is, whether it's office seismic safety, safety at heights, hearing protection, PPE, we also encourage our employees to take this home. You know, you're valuable to us here, you're also valuable to us at home. I actually took the, when you said bookcase, my wife just had a 7-foot bookcase put in, so the first thing I did is I put L brackets so it doesn't fall over on me, because it's over my chair, not hers.
You gotta put those chains up.
But yeah, so we encourage all the time. Everything we do, driving safety, that's a standard as our safety presentations or meeting minutes. So you had a question, sir?
Peter? Any additional questions?
I just had a cute one.
What's that?
Did you do the cafeteria yet?
The cafeteria is in our process. We are upgrading the cafeteria also, yes.
Because we're proud of saying that if you're in a cafeteria when the earthquake hits anywhere in California, you want to be in our cafeteria.
That's exactly right.
Because this is Lawrence Berkeley Lab, because we have a cafeteria that when you walk in, you can't really notice it unless you pay attention. Everything there has been seismically secured in a way that, you know, we don't have big piles of glasses. Just little things like that became part of that culture along the way.
And we are in the process. We've removed some of our HVAC ducts that used to hang down over the windows in the atrium. Those are now, we took those out. Our goal is to eliminate instead of trying to restrain if we can.
It's kind of amazing how, as soon as this...
Any other questions or comments?
Yeah. I asked before about security. So you didn't see anything where you'd wanted to do something and the security people says, gee, that's going to get in the way of my security mission.
Correct. Inside the power block, you're correct.
Because typically what the issue is access. But typically you're improving access, so that doesn't get in anybody's way.
That's correct.
Unless you relocated to some place that you didn't think was important for shutting the power block down. But the security people need it or something like that.
As of this time, we have had no issues
like
at this
that.
Time.
Yeah.
No, sir.
Because, I mean, obviously you can imagine that might have come up.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you very much, Ken.
Thank you, John.
Any questions?
Any public comment? Yes, please.
John Giesman on behalf of the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. Dr. Lamb has provoked me again, because I'm not certain that I would draw the same conclusion from this experience that he did as it relates to seismic safety at the plant. First, I want to commend the committee, congratulate Dr. Peterson, for your perseverance on this subject over the course of the last 4 years. You started focusing on this in 2010. It's gone through a couple of annual reports with pretty strongly worded recommendations before you've gotten what I would characterize as adequate attention from the company.
Mr. Giesman, you're exactly right. We, within the committee, we call this issue Peterson's baby.
Well, midway through that effort, mid-2012, Dr. Peterson and Mr. Wardell's fact-finding report gave you a flavor of what was at issue. Cabinets in the control room, briefing room, which reportedly had weights in their bases, easily tipped when shaken, suggesting that any counterweights that might be in these cabinets would not be effective in preventing them from falling over. Likewise, new tall cabinets had been installed into the control room shift manager's office without any seismic bracing and were aligned so that they would fall directly into the shift manager's workspace. A few locations in the INC laboratory had said that same fact-finding accurately characterized it, saying little progress appears to have been made during the past year. The acceptance of existing conditions can create an underlying belief by employees that earthquakes will not occur in this geographic area that is prone to earthquakes. This is a cultural problem, and I would suggest to you, during the same period of time, between 2010 and the current day, many of these similar cultural problems pervaded the company's approach to some of the seismic design issues at the plant. If you will recall, it was in September 2010 that Dr. Peck started raising concerns as to whether the shoreline fault exceeded the plant's safe shutdown earthquake requirement. The company's response was, after thinking about it, to try to change the definition of the safe shutdown earthquake. This is a cultural issue, and I think it extends to the amazingly sparse data collection effort supporting the ground motion model. Your recommendation, I think, hits the nail on the head by asking for a manager with the authority and the inclination to do something about the problem. My client, the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility, and I think the public at large making the same request of this committee, you should seek the authority and the inclination to assure that this pervasive cultural problem does not undercut the plant's review of its seismic design. Thank you.
Additional public comment? A discussion?
Yes, indeed. Mr. Giesman, thank you very much for your remark. I, for one, would take serious notice of what your statement had said. If you recall what I just said earlier, that this impressive piece of work before the committee, right now by Mr. Pazdan, sent a broadcast signal to the members of the public that they're serious about nuclear power safety. Now, your statement raised another point that perhaps the deficiency noted by Dr. Peterson perhaps would indicate a widespread lack of office furniture seismic safety, because as far as I remember, I do not recall there's any federal prescription as to how safe the office furniture should be in a nuclear power plant. Right? Given that situation, I thought what the plant has done in this particular issue is really over and beyond what the federal prescriptions are. That's the basis of my statement of this is a serious concern that they had expressed. As to what you are saying, that there's a widespread lack of safety culture as demonstrated by Dr. Peterson's discovery of deficiency, how meritorious that is, I would take serious notice.
These are questions of budget and managerial decision making. Mm-hmm. An example on the seismic side is State of California Public Utilities Commission provided the company 64 $1.25 million for enhanced seismic studies. Made very clear in its decision that it reasonably expected that the company might need more to complete that work, and more would be forthcoming if the company made such a request. At the same time, keep that $64 million number as a context, the ground motion side of the shack process, operating at a budget of about $2.5 million a year, which has been cut back, and Dr. Budnitz yesterday mentioned the high esteem that Dr. Abrahamson is held in throughout the seismic community, and I share that. But I think Norm would be the first to acknowledge the sparseness of data that has gone into the ground motion modeling. And that reflects a certain budget priority that is established by culture. Dr. Peterson has put his finger over 4 years on how that culture affects the furnishings of the office workplace and the potential threat to vital employees. But I am suggesting that the cultural problem is much more pervasive as it applies to the seismic risk here.
Now, yes, indeed, I am very sympathetic to what you are saying to him. My inquiry was, how do you keep everybody in tune with a safety culture that's necessary to protect the facility? You heard his response, and I hope that sheds some light in this current concern that you had raised. But I, as a final remark to your concern, I am very sympathetic to what you have said. Without you know, having an opinion as to how meritorious your argument is.
Well, I would suggest to you that when the first reaction at the plant to the resident inspector complaining that the shoreline fault does not comply with a safe shutdown earthquake, when that first reaction is, well, let's amend that test out of the license, to use the terminology I employed yesterday, that's a red flag.
Mr. Chairman, may I add some comments?
Yes, please.
Dr. Giesman, one, I wanted to thank you again for your comments. What I wanted to just bring forward, just so that you know you're aware. So PG&E definitely does a lot of analyses for seismic, as you are fully aware of that. And we have the geosciences staff with members that I think you are familiar with that are specialized in being able to perform those analyses. And I just want to go on record just to be pretty clear here, is that PG&E is fully committed to providing whatever funding that is necessary for us to be able to complete those analyses. Our nuclear safety is a paramount value for us. And so we take that very, very seriously. And it is not something that we would, you know, reduce efforts on. We want to make sure that we have the right people, which we believe we have some very, very technically competent people to do that. And we'll fund them to make sure that those analyses come out well.
I need to clarify one thing. Yesterday, some of my friends, in their overexuberance from the Mothers for Peace, referred to me as Dr. Giesman. But I think, as you all know, holders of the Juris Doctor degree typically do not use the term doctor. Some kind of ingrained hostility between the medical profession and the legal profession. A simple Mr. or John will suffice.
Okay. Okay, thanks.
Oh, Esquire. Esquire would be better.
I don't like being called doctor either. There's a Dr. Budnitz. He's in the medical side.
Yes, our pediatrician is a real honest-to-God doctor, and he's very good.
When it comes to seismic safety inside the plant with respect to safety-related equipment, the plant really goes above and beyond in terms of assuring, for example, that temporary tools or structures are located in such a way that they could never fall on top of a piece of safety-related equipment or potentially damage a piece of safety-related equipment. In the control room, if you go into the control room proper, there the sort of like the bookcases and stuff are actually bolted down onto the floor with these big, thick, almost half-inch thick pieces of L-angle bracing type of stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, so over-designed with respect to the actual loads and compared to what we do with conventional seismic bracing for furniture. And then you step into the office space and it's unregulated. Furthermore, to try to brace the furniture because you have to drill into concrete, which is safety-related concrete, requires somewhere on the order of about $100,000 of engineering analysis to verify that those holes are not going to cause damage. So my experience has been that when it comes to the safety-related equipment, that the plant really has been highly proactive in assuring that it will is likely to survive. And the question that emerges is the non-safety-related systems and how do we treat those? And this is something that is not well defined by the NRC. The NRC actually has no requirements with respect to safety of personnel. We had this very difficult debate about, in discussing this, is this something that we can, we think is a serious problem not to protect your employees just from an OSHA perspective, but that's not our mandate. And what we've concluded is that we do have non-safety related systems which still have safety significance, and that we need to assure that they receive appropriate special treatment. And this is a concept which is emerging in terms of how do we think about non-safety related systems that impact safety. For example, with the question of switching from direct cooling to cooling towers with some type of special treatment. The big gap here, I think, is that people really have not thought about the humans as being a critical element of how we manage residual risk during accidents. But this is changing, and furthermore, it's something that is really going to, I think, be thought through systematically with respect to making sure that the new flex type of programs are implemented in an appropriate way. So, but I would say that the thing that, you know, in talking with the plant staff, I asked them, you know, how does it feel you've got the system where there's an enormous focus on making sure that after the earthquake, all of the equipment is fine. But, you know, what does it tell your employees if, and the message finally got through. But this is something that I think is pervasive throughout the entire industry, and it's not within our charter to encourage the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to look at this question more broadly. But now that there's an example, finally, of some best practice being adopted, I really would hope that it's done systematically at all the other stations in the country, too.
Now, Mr. Giesman's concern is worthy of taking notice. Mr. Giesman's theory is for this specific area of office seismic safety, as Dr. Peterson has discovered, there had been numerous deficiencies. His thesis is that given that many deficiencies in this area, that would be indicative, quote unquote, this is Mr. Giesman's theory, that would be indicative of a widespread deficiency in safety culture. I mean, that thesis is worthy of me, mm-hmm. I would suggest worthy of the committee taking notice, because my surface on the committee, it has been one of my focuses. It's safety culture. I'm sure it's mm-hmm. you know, your focus and Dr. Butler's focus. And if I remind everybody here, one of the inquiry that I make is, well, how do you manage people here? As contrast to what I had been informed in the past by a United States three-star general, how he managed 10,000 soldiers was, I could not make my soldier obey me. And everything I told him to do, but I can make them regret he had not listened to me. Right. The plan had a different philosophy based on Mr. Welsh statement, based on the other senior management statement, the prescription. But to be fair to the facility, we now had seen a concrete effort to improve that area. But again, to go back to my sympathy to Mr. Giesman's thesis, if you had done so badly in this area, how could I trust you in another
place? That's a good line of observation. I think it's interesting also to look at how the plant responded when we raised the issue of the equipment hatch, which was as soon as a determination was made that there was an issue with respect to a safety-related function.
Well, they fixed it.
They fixed it immediately, and furthermore, they concluded that they could not have the hatch open during fuel motion unless it had been fixed during an outage. So with respect to a decision that related to something that clearly was within the safety basis or design basis of the plant, immediately, because that was also, if they had not, then they would not be complying with the license and with federal law. Outside of where the NRC has requirements, but where we see things which we believe are significant to safety, is the gray area.
During the same time period that you first raised the concern in May of 2010, 4 months later, the gas transmission pipeline in San Bruno exploded. Same company, same management, a deeply flawed probabilistic assessment had determined that certain pipes didn't require inspection. We have a tendency, it's human nature, to rely on legacy analyses, legacy practices, and I am suggesting that this is a red flag that should be evaluated as it applies to the company's seismic assessment of the plant's design.
Point well taken.
Yeah, I just want to comment about the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's regulatory approach in this area that we've been talking about. And I looked into it because I was almost sure I knew what it was, and I was right. The NRC has requirements that insist that after the earthquake that there be adequate access to all remote operations. In other words, if after the earthquake an operator has to go over to area number 23, I'm just pretending, to do something against all the various external events, they might be earthquakes or floods or tornadoes or whatever, there was an explicit requirement that they walk down looking for that, looking for access issues, lest there be something that escaped their attention. And all the plants did it. So it's not that the NRC is totally nothing there. They do have that requirement. I'm not arguing about it. It's not adequate, but it is what it is. And they also have requirements that every control panel, be it in the control room or maybe it's out at the turbines or wherever it happens to be, turbines aren't safety related, but but in the diesel generators, wherever there's a control panel, that has to be adequately anchored, and it is. What isn't there is the stuff that we heard about this morning. Okay, if it's not a control panel and it's not access to a remote operation, it's not in the regulatory scheme. Okay, I'm not arguing whether that's adequate or not. You can probably tell I don't think it's adequate. So I'll tell you I don't think it's adequate. But at least it's not as if they don't have anything. They have that, and they inspect against it. Okay?
Now, it's...
For what it's worth.
Right.
It's not adequate, though.
There's no dispute there, Dr. Butters. But I think Mr. Giesman's concern reached to another area.
Oh, I'm not arguing. I agree with you.
Right. I think Mr. Giesman's concern now is, if I read his statement correctly, if there's ambiguity in the federal design criteria or design basis earthquake, if there's ambiguity there, what is the confidence level that this facility would meet a major earthquake?
Oh, sure. They've been saying that for a long time.
Right. I mean, that is a consistent theme that I've been hearing. And I think that is worthy of significant further scrutiny by everybody. right? If the government does not tell the facility what the design bases are, what are they complying with? You know, he repeatedly mentioned Dr. Michael Peck's non-concurrence report, I mean, as a focus point of his inquiry. And I think that it's something.
But I also noticed that you never cite that a committee of seven experts on the staff reviewed Peck and disagreed with him.
Yes, indeed.
It's important to notice that there were 7-1. It wasn't
yes.
1-0.
Yes.
It's
yes.
very important that
yes.
that be cited
yes.
so the public knows that that isn't just what he said.
Right, right.
It's
but
really important.
However, 7-1 does not.
By the way, it doesn't make him wrong or right. It's just the fact. But to be really sure you're safe, you drive 20. You can't possibly violate any of them without knowing which one's right, or not knowing which of any of them's right, okay? Now, if that is in fact a metaphor for the situation out there, then you would feel comfortable that that driver is safe. He's going 20, because he doesn't know where it's 30, 20, 25, or 45, because the authorities screwed up, okay? That's a metaphor for this, and I have said right along that because I can't tell, I've said this more than once here, I've probably said it every meeting here for the last 2 years, I can't tell, and I've studied it. So I don't care what it is, I want to make sure that whatever it is, it's safer.
Now your metaphor... That is the
yes, point here.
Yes, yes, yes.
And now the authorities can decide whether the car is speeding and give them a ticket. I don't care about that. What I'm trying to figure out is whether it's safe.
Your metaphor
okay?
is most compelling.
However,
this is not necessarily the argument here.
Well, I think it is.
To me, the earthquake science is not mature enough. Nobody can come to this committee and inform the committee when and where and how big an earthquake
will
occur.
Wait. You misunderstand if you think that anybody needs to know when in order to design it safely. If you think that's what's needed, you're misinformed about how we design anything. Nothing in the world is designed because you have to know when.
What
we couldn't drive
big?
On bridges if
what
we had to know when.
What about how big? We do need to know how big.
You need to know how big so that you can make sure it can withstand
all
something
right.
bigger than how
all
big.
Right. All right. Uh-huh. To me, then.
Right?
All right. Let us remove,
I mean, that's the point.
Let us remove when and where.
Please don't say when and where. It's wrong.
All right. And that may not be wrong,
but
let me defer to your argument. Let us do not even talk about when and where. Let's talk about how big. Nobody can come before this committee and inform us how big the earthquake will be. Now, to me, that is a central element worthy of much more scrutiny. Because this plan, somehow, way back then, the federal government prescribed a design basis earthquake. Now we don't even know what it is. Now, whatever that level may be, Mother Nature do not comply necessarily with the United States federal government. If a big one, much bigger than what is prescribed by the government, happened, then what happened? Now, to me, that is beyond, before Fukushima, this is really beyond the charter of the committee. What would happen? And to me, that's worthy of...
That's exactly the question that I at least have been trying to deal with and address right along.
Yes, indeed. But your metaphor may or may not address that safety concern because I do not know what the margin is. You mentioned 35 miles, 40 miles, driving at 20. That metaphor within the parameter you prescribe is most compelling. But we may not be in that situation. Because if this facility was designed for this level of ground motion or of this level of threat, if somehow things happen at here, then how do we deal with that? In the past, it's unfair to ask that question.
Here's how we do. We try to do a realistic analysis of the actual capacity of the item. Right?
Against what threat?
No, the capacity. And then you can say... I'll just give you the example. Take a typical tank. You can say the tank was designed for 0.4G PGA with a spectrum, okay? But a capacity analysis reveals that spectrum with anchored at 1.2G will not cause it to fail, okay? And that at 1.5G, it just starts to have incipient failures. That is a capacity analysis. Now, you and I and everybody else has to judge whether the probability or per year of an earthquake that big is unacceptably too probable. But the thing we do is capacity analysis. The capacity meaning it's really the strength, but I'm using a more technical term for it. How strong is the gadget out there, sitting there as it sits, anchored, maintained, you know, as it sits? And that's the realistic analysis, which they did many years ago, which I relied on for my statements that it's strong enough, and which they're redoing again to their credit right now as part of the seismic PRA. They're doing it again, so they're going to look at it again to make sure that there wasn't anything that escaped their attention before, or maybe there's some changes in our knowledge. But
I have full confidence.
But that's the point, if you don't mind my saying.
Oh, yes, indeed. I have full confidence in what you just said, Dr. Bennis. But however, my point is related to another observation. Take the earthquake at North Anna. Way back when the plant was licensed and constructed and operated on, there was a federal description of its design basis earthquake. 2-3 years ago, a real earthquake occurred. It turned out that was much higher than what the design basis mentioned here. But the opponent's argument is worthy of taking notice. How could the federal government be so wrong in prescribing a design basis
Wait. The federal government wasn't wrong. You need to understand, and it's very important to understand. When I think the design basis of Point Anna was 0.2G with a Red Guide 160 spectrum, but I might be off. I can't remember. But let's pretend it was a 0.2G with a Red Guide 160 spectrum. There's a spectrum, so it 10 hertz and 5 hertz and so on. It's different. That was chosen with the explicit knowledge that the design code that ASME would use for designing tanks and the design code, the IEEE code for the seismic design of electrical systems, had margin so that that use of that design would produce something in the field with 0.5 or 0.7G. They knew that. If the codes didn't have extra margin, they'd have to prescribe a higher design basis. So they were done together because the engineering community knew full well, this is a very important point, that they have a quote design basis, but it was not that they couldn't exceed it. It was chosen to be used with the codes, with the margin in the codes. Okay. Everybody in the business knows that tanks have a margin of a factor of 3 or so, sometimes more.
Oh, yes, yes, indeed. That's most we are showing to
me. But that's just the point. So the fact that the earthquake exceeded the design basis wasn't a surprise to anybody in the seismic business. We expect that to happen every so often. But that's why the codes have the extra margin, so that the gadgets, I'm talking about the structures, the equipment, electrical stuff, all that stuff out there has extra margin. If it didn't have that margin, we would really not have a safe enough plant.
Yes, indeed. But my question is, the opponent's argument is worth your taking notice. What happened? Sure, you had a margin factor of 3. What happened, something much bigger than that were to occur? What happened to the facility? Do you have a margin of 10?
I can give you the answer to that. At North Anna, we have a seismic PRA that told us exactly where that was starting to get in trouble, and it was bigger than that.
Right. Margin of what? 3, 4, 5? To me, though, right, there's not enough money in the world to build something to a margin of 5 or 10. Right? We
may actually, civil engineers frequently do 5 to 10.
You don't think about it that way, Peter.
For civil engineers.
Peter, you don't think about it that way. You ask, for the earthquake at North Anna that would produce a ground motion sufficient to cause trouble, what is its... Now we know, okay? We don't know it exactly because there's a lot of uncertainty, but nevertheless, the seismic hazard studies in the East are far more sophisticated than they were because we've gathered the instruments all over the place, we've gathered a lot of data, and we understand a lot of stuff. And all that hazard work has come to a head in the last couple of years because we now know that the spectrum has more high frequency in it than we thought before, and the plants are doing a reevaluation against that, including a bunch of testing that EPRI is doing now of sensitive components. So you need to know that it is now thought that those items out there are liable to get in trouble at frequencies between 10 minus 5 per year and 10 minus 6 per year. Now, the NRC and members of the public have to decide whether 10 minus 5 per year and 10 minus 6 per year is safe enough. All right? That's a policy question. But we now know that they start getting in trouble with earthquakes that come around about 10 minus 5 per year, which is not zero, but it's not 10 minus 3 per year either. Okay? We know that. We know that with some uncertainty, but with some range of confidence.
I think that
I don't think it's a small point at all.
Right. But this is also a topic that we will be continuing. We will be continuing to discuss. So at this point, I'd recommend that we work to conclude. And I think that the key.
I think it's the key.
Maybe, please, John.
I wanted to respond to Dr. Budnitz's comment about those that overruled Dr. Peck's non-concurrence. And
well, I wouldn't say overruled. They just disagreed with it.
Those that disagreed with it. Set aside that the documents turned up in the Public Utilities Commission process where Dr. Peck's supervisor advised the company that their failure to be doing the double design earthquake calculation made it appear as if they were covering something up. Set that aside. You told me at one of our earlier meetings was the reason one didn't want to apply the damping assumptions and soil structure interaction assumptions associated with the double design earthquake to the shoreline fault was that it didn't yield a physical calculation, that it did not make sense in the physical world to do that.
Unrealistic physically, correct.
And that was the paragraph included in the disagreement, or literally it was an override, to Dr. Peck's non-concurrence. When the NRC management chose to this question, and it is yet to be resolved, I also briefly comment that your metaphor, I don't think, is completely accurate. The safe shutdown earthquake is not a speed limit.
No metaphors are, by the way.
It's a stop sign. And what you're suggesting, and for all I know, quite reasonably, is that it is safe to ignore that stop sign on a probabilistic basis. You're going 20 miles an hour. You're quite unlikely to hit anything. But what the NRC has ended up doing is leaving the stop sign in place. PG&E's first instinct was to amend the license. Let's get rid of that stop sign. But the stop sign is in place. The analysis is supposed to be conducted under the 54F process. Dr. Peck identified the problem in September of 2010. The company has indicated that it'll be 2017 or 2018 before they are completed with the follow-up to the 54F process. I submit to you 7 or 8 years is a long time to have a stop sign in place that there is some type of unspoken consensus can simply be ignored.
I'm not going to argue about the NRC's regulations because I think they're perverse. Right? You've heard me say that before. And I think the word perverse is about right. But I believe that the reason why the staff gets up in the morning, puts on their shirt, and comes to work and doesn't shut the station down is that they believe that what I've been saying remains so, that the equipment and the structures out there are strong enough, and that belief is what enables them to continue with this perverse system till all the new knowledge enables them to sort it out in some year's time. I would have wished they should have sorted it out years ago. It was kind of unfortunate, and it's really wrong that they didn't sort it out. But it's my belief that that's why the plant remains operating with a license. It's because they have examined the information that I've examined. They asked for that information in 1987, whenever it was. It's called the Long-Term Seismic Program. And they asked for that information. It was submitted. They reviewed it. They said, okay, that remains their basis. The basis is not that thing which you're talking about. The basis is the Long-Term Seismic Program and the judgments that they made about it then, which they continue to review each year. And that they reviewed again in the context of the shoreline fault. And that's why I think I can't speak for them because a
PG&E employee.
Someday they'll get it straight.
I believe that every PG&E employee in the gas department and every manager above the gas department sincerely believed those pipelines were adequately safe.
I have no knowledge of that.
Well, I am willing to take it on faith that they were sincere in their belief. The question is whether they're right. Now, about the plant's design.
The question is, do they have a basis?
Okay.
They're right. The question is, do they have a basis?
We've had some good public discussion. Any additional public comments?
Just a little bit. I'm Sherry Lewis, San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. The factor that changes things to me in this discussion is whether or not something is very expensive to deal with. And the double design to follow that means that things have to be changed and it's going to be very expensive. And so that comes into enabling one to believe that something is safe enough. Believing can also be denial. So
that's true.
So you have to pay attention to that. And what the comparison with the hatch closing, that probably doesn't cost very much money to close a hatch. But to bring equipment up to a new, a double design standard that now has to include something more severe because of the new shoreline earthquake, that will be very expensive. And when you were talking about things being a margin of error, one of the problems with this getting rid of the double design aspect was you were losing some of your margin, and that's what the problem was. You want to make sure that whatever design you have, that there always is that extra margin.
Yes, ma'am.
And they were eating up some of that margin.
Okay, so you're entirely, just to say, you're entirely right in that perspective. That perspective is exactly the correct perspective, okay? About how much margin there is and whether that margin has been, we use the word eroded, but it's the same idea. And it's just that we, I particularly, but the rest of us, are trying to be attentive to, okay? Because I think that's the right perspective, because we're trying to understand its realistic performance, okay? Its realistic performance.
Okay. Other comments?
That's just right.
Thank you very much. At this point, I think it's time for a
Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering, and is held an SR, a Senior Reactor
Davis.
Operator.
Wow.
Senior Reactor Operator's license.
Are you one of the very few ladies who had the SRO in the country?
I have a SRO cert. I'm one of the few women in the country that
in
has
the country.
SRO cert.
But you know what? A zillion of them are coming up. Isn't it wonderful?
Yes, it's really good.
I mean, you know, I have a daughter that age that
good.
Couldn't do what she was doing herself.
Yes.
30 years ago.
Yeah, okay. I'm really excited. You know, I'm disappointed that our classes of 15 people don't have 15 women. But, you know, one or two is at least better than none.
Well, you know, in the country's law school and medical school, women's are now the majority.
That's right.
Thank God.
We can get, I can talk about that. It's not on my agenda. Let's see. So I'm Lynn Walter, as Carrie introduced me, and I'm a resident of Avila. And I first, before I get started, want to thank you for having this venue here in the town that I live in. I love the fact that this town is very vibrant right now, and I raised my kids here, so it's really exciting to me that we have this facility. Thank you for choosing it. So last year, I was here, also in this facility, introducing our new five-year operating plan. And this year, I'm here to kind of review how we did based on the initiatives that we set out for ourselves in 2013, and then give you a look at what changes to the initiatives we're doing in 2014. So first off, I want to say that I just want to cover some of the key activities for 2013. We're most proud of our Unit 2 refueling outage. First of all, like we do in every outage, we brought in about 1,000 extra workers, some of them from afar who spent motel room money and restaurant money here in this community. We did such a great job selecting and training those employees. Our outage was the safest outage we've ever had. We had no recordable injuries. We also had the best performance in human performance of any outage. We're very, very proud of that. That's so important to us. The major projects that we installed in that outage, this refueling outage was in the beginning of 2013, we learned from previous outages, and so the implementation of those projects was even better, the best we'd ever done. We spent $1 million contributed greatly to keeping our workers at a dose as low as reasonably achievable. You know, at this point, no other U.S. nuclear plant has the upgrades to their plant control system that we do. And so our refueling outage this year greatly enhanced our safety, and for that we're really proud. So,
Lynn?
Yeah.
I had understood that others are coming here to learn from your experiences. Is that so?
That's right. We get benchmarked a lot for the projects that we've installed and for our digital upgrades that we've been doing for the last several years. We're at the forefront upgrading all of our digital feed water and lots of our systems in the control room.
Yeah, just as a personal note, I was someplace to be unnamed and talked to somebody at another plant that said that they were using Diablo as a best mark for best practices. And so that's, you know, worth, the public ought to know that goes on.
Yeah. And we benchmark others. For
course, you go elsewhere, too, when
yes.
you find something.
Yeah, we do. And I'll talk about that a little bit. Let's see, just some other key activities. You know, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission looks at our legacy calculations. Every 3 years, for example, we have a component design basis inspection. And they go in much detail, many layers, to specific systems and components that that are predominantly important for us. And this inspection this year was really successful. They even left, which is unusual for the NRC, with positive comments about our design, the components that they looked at. The other thing is we did have another NRC inspection, also very important. It was a force-on-force inspection. That's where they test the ability of our security force to thwart any outside force. And then this is 2014, but really last year was a big year for preparation for this. Every 4 years, our operations training programs do go get reviewed by the accrediting board for renewal. And I'm happy to report that in January, a contingent of leaders came to the National Nuclear Training Academy Board, which is an independent accreditation board. And after the review of the site visit that the team had done during 2013 and questioning of the leaders and some of our personnel who are in the training programs themselves, we received renewal. So the first 3 hours, they are the more tactical things that we needed to succeed in for 2013. And then the team, those are more strategic. In other words, those will take and be with us for the next 5 years at least. So outage planning and execution, use of human performance tools, I addressed those in our 2013 results. Reinvigorating employee engagement, really important to us. Our employees have a lot of knowledge. We recognize that it's important to have a collaborative team so that we, instead of just getting compliance, we get commitment from our employees. Having them involved in our decision making is very, very important to us. So this is an important tactical area. Also, knowledge retention, I'll talk about that what we're going to be doing in 2014. We solidified our program there. Enhancing our facilities, you heard from Mr. Pasden about what we've done to some of our facilities. And as you know, technology is always changing. We want our employees to be at the forefront of this technology, and so it's really important that their working environment give them the tools that they can do the job safely and efficiently. Achieving a better work-life balance was an initiative that we wanted to start looking at in 2013. We continue to look at it. It's a very strategic area for us. Last year, we provided our employees flexible schedules, telecommuting options where their job would allow, and assistance with childcare. These are very important for especially our younger workers who have young families. So, and then overarching is the M in team, which is maintaining a safe and event-free operation. So let's look at some of the tactical initiatives in 2013. What I really want to highlight here is the actual things that we did in 2013. For outage, planning and execution, the O, we have formed an outage management team, which has been very effective. The outage management team is actually together throughout the year, and though we had a successful outage in the beginning of 2013, this outage management team has been working to prepare for the first outage of 2014 and the second outage that we have in 2014. It's a two-outage year. This outage management team used some industry-leading tools. One was a priority system, one was the way to do risk reviews of the scope and the schedule, and also to tie the schedule to the cost basis for the using employee input for the tool that we're going to purchase in March.
Can you describe what the word innovation tool means?
Yes, okay. So When our supervisors and leaders are out in the field, what we are doing is observing our workers and observing their behaviors, observing the problems that they're having in the field, and we collect that data in an observation software. And what we do is we take a look at on a routine basis, we take a look at all the observations and we see if there's any trends, any areas of concern. For example, one of the areas last time we did the trend was work control process was creating some barriers for people to really get their work done. So what we do is we fix those particular problems that we find. So even one observation, we do thousands of observations, so you don't want to have actions based on every single observation, but together they're important for the trend that they...
But you're observing the people.
We're observing the people.
That's what this is. Mm-hmm. These aren't observations about equipment.
No, but if you're an observer...
Obviously it's tied to that.
Right.
Go ahead.
We do make observations on a material condition if we notice something.
Of course you do. I know. Yeah. But this you're talking about is observations of equipment.
Of people.
People.
That's right.
As opposed to observing that the pressure gauge remains where it's supposed to be.
Absolutely. Yeah.
For
you're
the
right.
pressure of some pipe or something, right?
Right.
Okay. Which you also do, but that's a different.
Those are our surveillance. Surveillances.
I wasn't arguing the case, just trying to explain it to.
Okay.
Right.
We also implemented a new human factors analysis tool. When we have a human performance issue, what we've done in the past is really focused on the human. But in fact, there's a whole organization that sets that human up for the performance that they have. So this new human factors analysis tool allows us to really dig into the organizational influences for human behavior. We revise our site standards handbook. This is a handbook that every employee in our station carries with them. It's more user-friendly, and it's with employee input as to what items that they want in here. We have our safety standards. We have the nuclear safety culture standards, procedure use and adherence, signage. All of that is in here. And so the way it's used is it's really... We also identified department and section clocks so that each individual worker knows how their work group is doing performance-wise compared to the other sections in their department. R is the reinvigorating employee engagement. We're really proud that our facilitative leadership training program trained 250 of our leaders last year. Our Passport to Knowledge, which is our knowledge management program, has really solidified, and we're utilizing it on a routine basis. And then continuous simplification and improvement, it's a program that's been around for a long time, several years. We finished 49 projects this year. These are projects that employees who are doing the work identify ways that their work can be streamlined or made easier or improved by improve the quality, save dose, be more safe, lots of criteria. But we finished 49 of those, and we provide the employee the resources and the help to make the changes they need to make it better for them. So Moving on, within PG&E, Diablo Canyon represents just a portion of our clean air portfolio. And in 2014, all of our utility-owned generation has three main priorities. First of all, it's public safety. Second of all, it's worker safety. And third, it's reliability. And the utility industry is changing, especially in California, and in order to remain competitive and doing business in California, we've got to be the best we can be, and our performance is really important. And our 2014 operating plan is laid out to do that, to help us, to guide us along the way.
So PG&E, when I was a kid, was generating a lot of electricity by burning oil that then got changed to gas.
That's right.
When I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And of course, there was always hydro.
Yes.
What is left that PG&E actually does besides the hydro in this plant that owns?
We have some gas-fired plants.
Oh, okay. You still have...
Yes, but they're not oil-fired, so...
No, of course, there's no oil. But the big gas plants...
But that doesn't count in our clean oil...
But the big gas
clean
plants...
Clean portfolio. It's not clean.
The big gas-fired plants that PG&E ran in those days are gone.
Yeah, that's right.
Original.
That's right. Remember the Antioch plant?
I know.
It was very dirty, but we now have what we call the Gateway plant on the same location. Okay.
Sure.
It's cleaner. It's not as clean as nuclear. Focus on rigor in implementing our milestones for these outages. We're going to ensure effective risk recognition and contingency planning and bridging strategies for implementation and outage execution. And we're going to do the appropriate maintenance and upgrades to our electrical system to help our reliability. The next one is the U in our, and that is use of human performance tools. I've already talked a little bit about that, but we are going to be utilizing first-line supervisor and employee teams on benchmarking and self-assessments. We did this at the end of 2013, but we're going to continue in 2014. We found that it's really helpful to take a worker at Diablo Canyon, take them to a plant that's doing that type of work really well, and let them see firsthand. Whereas before, managers and directors would go to these benchmarking and then bring it back. We're sending our workers themselves. It's very effective.
Yeah.
We are enhancing leadership in the field. Okay, if you go to the plant Monday through Saturday, you will see leaders in the field for 6 hours, starting at 6 in the morning. That is something different. We're really engaging with the employees. We're building relationships with them, and we're helping them solve problems that they encounter every day.
This is actually a very interesting sort of noteworthy thing to force senior leadership to do on a routine basis. Is it sustainable? Because it really does, actually, it is very positive to get the leadership out spending a substantive amount of time in the plant and observing work as opposed to sitting at their desk and answering emails.
Or meetings.
Or yes.
So speaking
that,
as
that
one of those
email and meetings, yes.
Speaking as one of those leaders, it's sustainable for me because my chief nuclear officer, my site vice president, my station director is supportive mm-hmm. of this. In the past, I don't think we've had that support. So when you're not at the required meeting because you're in the field, that's okay. And I love being in the field. All of our leaders, we'd rather be in the field than sitting in a meeting. But so it is sustainable because it's got support from the very top of our organization.
Okay.
Not only that, it's rewarding. You know, you talk to employees, you understand on a different level what they...
Or an SRO, Dave.
He was a reactor operator.
Okay, he was a reactor operator, but his...
He's also qualified security.
But his assignment...
Yep.
His assignment was... They do this every day. His assignment was to spend a few hours walking around the turbine building where he made between 50 and 75 observations of different things. And he would, and I just want you to imagine, he walked up to a vessel, and there was a gauge where he read the pressure, okay? And then he walked 12 feet away, and he went to another gauge where he read a voltage. He went somewhere else, and in a couple of hours, he made I don't know, 50 or 75 of these observations. Now, 20 years ago, I remember perfectly well, that same person would have been writing it down on a pad. He'd say, the pressure is 220. He'd say, and the voltage is whatever it is. He'd bring it back, and then he'd have to write it down, and they'd compile it, okay? Now, you got to imagine how much better this is. He's got a little handheld device that's all programmed in there. He knows that observation number 3 is that pressure, and observation number 4 is that voltage. He can't get out of order because it's all programmed for him. And furthermore, he types in 220. I'm just pretending that's the pressure. He can see that it's been 220 for the last 3 weeks. So he knows, we're about right. If he made a mistake and read 320 instead of 220, he'd see it and say, oh, that's off. He'd go back to the gauge and see whether or not it was right or whether he made the mistake. In the old days, it'd be on a pad of paper, and you go back, and then somebody had to go back out again and check it. So this is a way, you know, in other words, if there really is a trend, he wants to make sure it's right, and if it's the same, he knows it's the same, and he knows that that's also right. So it's a way, and the public ought to understand that this person not only can see that what he's doing, he or she, is making sense, the observation, because that person, for example, might not necessarily remember or know what the pressure's supposed to be, but now he sees what it's been. And furthermore, it's all recorded there, so that when we got back to the control room at the end of this, he was able to print out for us all the observations. On a beep, 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 and we got these pages of this stuff, and we could see the observations and what they were the last time and so on, and see the trends and the drifts, and which one was out of spec. There was only one out of 50 or 100 that was out of spec, and we saw it, and we understood it. And furthermore, he didn't leave any out because it told him what the next one was. It's a way of not only increasing productivity and assuring thoroughness, but alerting the observer to the significance of the measurement that he or she is making. And tools like this, which are becoming common in the industry, but of course you're using them, to access who's that, maybe that somebody owns that heat exchanger, and there's something off, that person's got, it's all right there.
That's right.
It's an amazingly productive and more accurate way of observing what's going on in the plant.
Okay. So that's one of the fun things to do as a leader is go along with the turbine watch. They do this, you know, twice a day.
Shifts. Right. Mm-hmm. How many are there? 75 or something? I can't remember a number like that. Whatever, a bunch of these things.
Well, there's turbine building rounds, there's aux building rounds, there's containment rounds, right. There's intake rounds and outside rounds.
There's also now the ability to stage video cameras. You can use wireless communication to have online monitoring of certain indications where it might be valuable. Ability to monitor the status of a plant has improved substantively, and also to automate the processes of alerting you to trends or changes
right.
as well. And
yeah,
I think we're only scratching the surface
yes.
because the nuclear stays far behind other industries
yes.
in this area.
Well, but Lynn, and this is where I'm coming back to you, this you here. The primary way to motivate employees is for them to understand the significance of what they're doing rather than only understanding that it's necessary for them to do it. And you would, there isn't anybody in the room who could disagree with that. This sort of tool, and it's only one of many, provides an understanding for them of the significance of what they're doing in a way that's different. Because it's in real time,
mm-hmm.
and you know, it really, this particular person had understanding and an ownership of the job he was doing at that time. It was really very good.
Okay. I'm glad you had an opportunity to do that.
Well, yeah, you know. And
we have really good operators. They're very professional.
I'm not going to argue that. We watch this one person.
And yeah, okay. They're all like that.
No, I'm not going to argue that. I haven't seen anything but that, but this, it was just really nice. Okay.
Okay, so let's see where I'm at. The last bullet I think I haven't covered, it's the other thing we want to do in 2014 is emphasize behaviors to stop when unsure or to stop when the documents don't work as written and reinforce a questioning attitude. When we study all of our human performance, what we see is that we have very, very...
Get back up to that last bullet.
Go back.
I guess I'd ask, what's new? You've been doing that for years. What's new on this particular case?
New is the awareness of how important that is. I mean, in the previous years, I think we've picked off the lower hanging fruit of human performance. Now we're really going for the hearts and minds of people to get them to understand the importance of everything that they do out there is part of a greater team. It's not just on them. And I think it's a culture change. And that's why it's emphasizing the behavior. It's not a new behavior. It's emphasizing it more, increasing the emphasis in 2014 on that.
We noticed,
did that answer your question?
Sort of. Maybe we'll look at that at a fact-finding meeting to kind of see more specifically what you're doing.
Okay.
Well, I actually think that part of the culture change, we saw it during this walk down. Let me describe. We came to one observation, partway down the list, and the fellow couldn't do it. And the reason he couldn't do it was there was a maintenance team working on that thing.
Mm-hmm. That's a good example.
Now, actually, they weren't working on that thing. They were working on something adjacent to it that made access difficult. Now, I can imagine that only a few years ago, our fellow would have gone in there, found his way around the maintenance thing, and gone to the back and made his reading. But he didn't. He said, I'm not going to go there. I'll come back in 2 hours when they're out of there. Even though the observation was doable, but it was going to be an interference with another activity. And I'm trying to imagine that deference to another activity is probably more common than it was. It was probably less likely years ago. The person said, well, the heck with that, I'm just going to go around and do what I do. And that deference to other activities, lest you interfere with them or distract them, was a good behavior that I think is probably more common because of these emphases than it would have been.
That's right. It's about emphasizing the things that you want your culture to be going towards. So, rewards and sanctions, that's the culture. So we want to reward the right behaviors and make sure that's what we recognize.
Ms. Waters, may I ask you a difficult question?
Sure.
You were in the audience when Mr. Giesman had offered his interpretation of what the safety culture, the plan, is. In my business, there's only one set of facts. There are multiple sets of interpretation. Mr. Giesman's interpretation was based on Dr. Peterson's discovery of where is the truth as you see it? Is it somewhere in between? Or does it tilt decidedly towards one side of the two interpretations? That's question number one. Request then, number one, is if possible, in your next presentation, would you enlighten us as to what are the markers of a successful safety culture, as some of your slide messages are. I think implicitly they are telling me that. Did I read your slides correctly?
I think so. I think you can interpret that, but...
Right. Then okay. May I ask you to answer question number one and then do my request number one as well?
Okay. All right. Your first question was, I'm not going to... I think it's a really good question that Mr. Giesman asked, and that is, does our thought process with seismic safety for furniture, does it translate to things that matter in the nuclear safety world? That's a question we ask ourselves every day. And if we didn't ask ourselves that question every day, I'd be worried about, saying that our safety culture is strong. But that is why I think we want to. It's kind of, how do I answer this question? External observers of our safety culture. We do a safety culture survey of external peers. They come in and look at our safety culture, and they provide their observations. The last few that we've had, it's been very positive. There's always room to improve, and it's things like these questions that we utilize as our springboard to really tune up our safety culture, because it's everything. What is safety culture? It's everything we do.
So your peers are not only the proponent of the industry, but opponents of the industry as well. Is that what you're saying?
say...
You mentioned your peer review, you take peer comments seriously. The question is, your peer are not only the proponent of the industry, but opponents as well.
I would say that our company and Diablo Canyon take very seriously this committee's comments, this committee's recommendations, as well as the public comments that we hear in the public meetings.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think I've ever missed one since the Truman administration, where we got our first television in 51 and Truman gave it. And I don't think I've missed one, although I might have.
Truman.
Yes, I'm telling you, we got our first television in 51, and I watched Truman. And I can't remember a State of the Union address, and I bet you can go and find them, in which the last line of the State of the Union address was the president telling the Congress and the public that the State of the Union is strong. Every president says that. It's got to be the last line. And then he says, God bless America, thank God, and then, you know, everybody claps. Now, in all those years, I don't think the State of the Union has been uniformly strong, if you don't mind my saying, especially when I think that the Union means a union of states. Boy, oh boy, I can tell you it wasn't all that strong in the 60s when I was, you know, in graduate school and there was horrible things going on in our southern states. It wasn't as strong as it became later. And so I become a sort of a skeptical observer of the State of the Union address when the president says the State of the Union is strong. That's a metaphor. I can't imagine somebody like you telling us that the state of your safety culture wasn't strong. I'm not accusing you in any way. I really am not. I mean, I take you straight, honest, and I believe you, and we've talked, and so I can take that straight. But you do have to think that despite that, and we have to be, you know, realistic that not everything is going to work all the time, right?
That's correct.
For sure.
I didn't mean to imply that everything's perfect.
I wasn't saying that you were, because I know that you know better, and I honor you for that. I mean, I have no complaint here. I just think that part of the job, part of your job, is similar to part of our job, which is to maintain realistic observations coupled with a skeptical viewpoint, right?
That's right.
And
we have to be self-critical, but we, just to check that we are being self-critical, we have to bring outside people in to look.
So you're allowed to be self-critical, I know you are, and that's good, but that's not the same as saying that Obama isn't going to tell us the State of the Union is strong. Of course he's going to say that. He's going to say the State of the Union isn't strong, or he's going to be silent about it when every predecessor for the last decade has always said that? You know what I mean? You can't. You can't not be silent about it.
If I could draw a parallel to the plant, and our observation, and we also learned in one of our fact-finding visits, what did you mean when you said that you needed to improve? You know, what did you mean when you said that the State of the Union was strong? And so they're getting feedback not only to the workers, but then they're also getting feedback
to the supervisor,
whomever did the observation and said you need to be more clear.
Feedback myself.
So that was one of the things that was impressive, that you're recognizing that the process itself can even be more refined to provide the specific things that are expected as far as behaviors.
Yeah.
And so I think that's something that probably the industry could benefit from too.
Right. And the thing I said a few minutes ago about watching this RO walking around the turbine building, and Dave and I accompanied him for a couple hours, that was my direct observation of safety culture at work. And I know you do that too, thank God, and that's part of your job, and you said so. There's no substitute for that, and I know you've said that too, right?
We recognize it's important to be out in the field because culture is what you sanction and reward. You are sanctioning it.
And you can't see it in your office.
No.
I mean,
exactly.
And I purposely didn't go into great detail when we wrote up the report, but we wrote down the fact that this worker that we observed, this turbine operator, used good human performance tools.
Yeah, he did.
Specifically, though, which I didn't write into the report, was that when he went up to read on a panel of gauges, he would point at the gauge that he's human performance, make sure you're not just glancing, you're actually pointing at the physical gauge that you're going to record, and then you're doing the recording. When he called the control room or whomever he was talking to in the operations group, carried on conversation, we'd hear him say he would repeat back something that he heard from the person, or sometimes when he initiated and made a comment to somebody and then they repeated it back, he would say, "That is correct," in the three-way communication. So we were seeing those specific human performance tools being used in the field, which is reassuring.
So I was reassured. Of course, you know, it's one data point, but boy, it was a good one. You know, it's
okay.
Good.
Let's see. Where was I? Okay.
Sorry to interrupt.
Well, I'm not sorry to interrupt.
We got plenty of time. It's our meeting.
All right. Good. Okay. The R in our team is reinvigorating employee engagement, and I think I talked about this earlier. In 2014, we're going to continue to reinforce our facilitative leadership skills that we learned in 2013. We're going to do that by putting on mentoring sessions and reinforcing it in our continuing leadership class. The second thing is to utilize an employee advisory council to identify opportunities and to align around organization on what's the best way to do things safely. I've just covered the three tactical initiatives in our 2014 operating plan, and now I'll cover the strategic initiatives. These, of course, are here for the next 5 years at least. The first one is, like many industries, obviously, we're looking at a segment of our population that is nearing retirement, and we're getting ahead of that. And we're doing that by involving our workforce in benchmarking to identify best tools and processes for knowledge management and transfer, by leveraging technology such as the use of wiki-type applications and videos to store and access key knowledge, by upgrading our procedures to ensure that tacit knowledge of our workers is included in the procedures for our newer workers. And we're using extensively mentoring, and we're pairing up a seasoned worker with a new employee. And this has been very, very effective. I've seen a lot of growth by the new employees.
We've seen that too. We'll do a fact finding. Let's just pick an area, a particular system. And the owner is a seasoned person that brings along a younger person who's going to be taking it over next year.
Yep.
Yeah. We've seen a good deal of that, all of us, in the last 2 or 3 years.
So I'll cover the remaining three initiatives in 2014. That's the E and team is enhance our facilities. I think you heard a lot of that from Mr. Pasden. So we have a 5-year plan for infrastructure. The goal is, you know, we want to advance the use of wireless technology in our plant, and we want our employees to have the most up-to-date tools to do their job. It's really the future. Next, for the A in our team, the initiative is achieving work-life balance. I think I talked to you a little bit about what we did in 2013 with the child care and the flexible working schedules. We're going to continue to focus on the continuous improvement program, because that really helps employees, while they're at work, do their work efficiently, and it's not so burdensome and frustrating for them. We're also going to take a look at cumulative effects that we've piled on over the years. It's created a huge administrative burden, particularly for our first-line supervisor. So again, getting them away from their desk and out in the field helping their employees, that's our goal. And then we're going to focus on fitness in 2014. One of the facility improvements is to redo our fitness facility. We're going to put key controls in place for protecting our vital power and simplify our corrective action program, provide industry-leading work control strategies, and definitely upgrading our equipment for greater reliability. So that's a summary of our 2014 operating plan initiatives, and as you can see, we're not resting on our laurels of 2013, though we had some successes that we're proud of. We are in relentless pursuit of continuous improvement at Diablo Canyon.
Lynn,
thank you.
Can you say anything more about simplifying our corrective action program?
Yes, I'd be glad to talk about that.
Yeah, but what do you mean? What kinds of things?
You know, we've taken some steps already, but we want to make it so easy for an employee to bring up issues. They can go to the website now and just push one button and write what their issue is. We have anonymous, so if they're embarrassed, they can write an anonymous notification. And that notification gets reviewed by a multidiscipline group of employees and managers, and every question is answered, every concern is taken seriously.
This is very interesting. I'd just like to interject that this would be very good for us to look at in the fact-finding. The new approach to corrective action and the simplification, and especially this is quite interesting, the capability to enter anonymous notifications. Mm-hmm. Just to get that onto our action item list, because it sounds great.
Yeah,
I agree, because for a while I was concerned the facility had developed too many procedures, too many programs. You know, it had become so bureaucratic.
Yeah.
Right. This simplification is welcome.
Right. And bureaucracy is not our friend. We want to put barriers in place so people can't make errors, but we need to strip away the bureaucracy and the steps they have to go through.
Right, because right. These analogies is, you know, somebody had developed 50 pages plan to how to start a car or turn on the radio.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Go back one slide, because I want to ask a question. The second bullet, and you're not going to get me to disagree with that, improving key controls for protecting vital power. They had a bullet like this on their slide. It was the analog. And they were giving an all-hands briefing, as you imagine you do. This is another station, but it mm-hmm. might as well be here. And they were approached by the individual who owns service water. For those of you that don't understand, service water is water that is pumped around the plant that cools vital equipment, cools the bearings and pumps, and cools, if we don't have self-cooled diesels, it cools the diesel generators. And without service water, the plant isn't going to be safe. It is as important as vital power. And I'm relaying to you that the individual, this is an anecdote, but I'm just relaying, that they had a slide like this about protecting vital power. Of course, it's all part of the flex thing, is, you know, right? We want to make sure we've got power there, even in these very unusual circumstances. And said, yeah, but you left me out. I want as much emphasis on service water, as this, because it is also an essential element maintaining the plant in a safe condition, when it's running and when it's shut down. So I want to ask a question. With this bullet being there, and I'm glad it is, can you tell me about anything you're doing that's special or any highlight about service water at this time, or is it not necessary? Did you do that last year? Is there some reason why you have this? I would have thought that before you put this bullet down here, you already had very high confidence that vital power was going to be reliable and there when you needed it. I hope.
Yes.
We've been reviewing that for years. We review service water too. Why is this suddenly on the slide?
We have to, and you're right, we always protected our vital equipment.
I hope so.
But we always have to increase the robustness of our barriers.
Yeah, I agree with that too.
Not everyone's a nuclear engineer at the plant.
Of course not. Most of them aren't, actually. Most of them aren't. They have specialty in what they do, yeah.
So in the past, we would just maybe have it in the shift order or the daily shift brief, what was protected equipment, so people knew, you know, in their mind what to stay away from. Well,
and
okay, that was years ago.
And
now,
if they were doing maintenance on something, they knew that this, at least, they got to protect it.
Right. Yeah. Now, go several years in the future to today, we have robust chains, signs, covers over critical buttons, because sometimes in a panel you have unit one here and unit two right next to it. So we protect, if we're working on unit one, we want to protect unit two.
And we've seen that, so go ahead. Yeah.
So it's just a higher level and focus on robust barriers. The other part of it is ensuring that we communicate really well to our employees. And so today what we have is a daily brief. Now, daily brief goes to every single worker in the plant that day and says, these are our protected equipment. We're doing this work, and this is what we're protecting.
Well, so then that said, is there some program that's doing that, but where the last two words are service water? Or if not, is it because it isn't needed now, or are you going to do it next year? Or you, maybe you're going to tell me, I'm not arguing, that it's already well protected, which I believe.
No, it does include our auxiliary saltwater system, our aux feedwater system, all the safety components. Yes, those are included. Our diesels. Kerry looks like he has something to help me out with.
Okay. I remember walking into the diesel room with Furman once, and he was standing there.
Yeah, he used to be the diesel engineer. Okay.
What are you doing here?
So we had a couple of plant trips as a result of flashover events last year, and so part of that, out of that outcome is, you know, let's make sure that we aren't working on anything that could potentially cause a trip to the plant, and so we protect that with a boundary and tail boards. If anyone's going to be in the area doing work, it gets a risk review, et cetera. So that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, the one thing that I would add to that is, again, it's all a part of continuous learning and getting better. You know, we look at our performance year over year, and we look to see where we have had challenges. So we have the programs, as you described, that protect all of our equipment. But as we continuously learn that, you know, in one particular area, such as vital power, we've had more challenges, then we assess that and decide that we need to, you know, do more in that area to heighten the emphasis on it so that we can make improvement in that area. So it's an ongoing evaluation, and you know, at this point in time, when we look back at our performance protecting auxiliary salt water, we haven't seen significant challenges. Now, there's still the ongoing program for that, so we make sure that that's done, but we want to put the emphasis where we do see those gaps so that we can close them.
Please continue.
I am done. I'm at the
perfect
thank you slide.
Okay.
We need a break.
Additional discussion by the committee?
I'm having a good time.
Just one thought. There was, in this presentation, there was a lot more information specific, and I can understand it, because last year the new approach was just being developed.
Right.
And so now you're able to talk specifically about the things that were going on.
Next time you can get a copy.
What would also be helpful in the future, especially at this time of the year, is, and what I was hoping to get was the actual performance data. You know, there are certain goals.
Oh, okay.
Physical performance data that, not many, it was about a dozen.
I thought that
as far as what was the goal, and and then being able to look ahead for 2014, what that would be. We're going to look at that on site, but in a public meeting, I think it would be helpful at this time to have that.
I thought that Jim Welsh did that, some of that.
Did
last night? No,
it wasn't there.
Okay.
It wasn't. There were about a dozen things that are on your, you know, for your annual plan.
So I've heard markers of safety culture is something you're interested in the future, and also actual performance data.
Performance data. Yeah. Okay.
Well, thank you. Sorry.
Other comments, questions? Okay. Thank you, Lynn. It's now time for public comment related to this presentation. Okay.
John Giesman on behalf of the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. I hesitate to besmirch this picture of the plant and its workforce as the happiest place on earth, but I wonder if Ms. Walter could describe how the station has responded to the downgrade of its INPO rating. And whether or not that response has triggered any changes in the operational plan. You elected yesterday not to talk about that, but perhaps she can in appropriate general terms.
Thank you. Additional? Let's go ahead. Additional public?
We get to talk first, and I want to tell you that I think that's out of scope. We've made an arrangement where we don't talk about INPO. And the reason for that is that their arrangement about confidentiality is understood by us, as it is by the regulator, as being too important for us to talk about, and so we just don't.
So, Mr. Giesman, I would like to also comment on that. So, the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations, so their reviews of all nuclear stations, not just Diablo Canyon, is proprietary information, and so we are legally prohibited to discuss that But what I can tell you is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is our primary regulator, and so they look at all aspects of our business. And in their latest assessment for us at the end of cycle was that we operate the plant safely, and we're meeting all of the requirements. So I just wanted to let you know that that's we're legally prohibited from that, and the NRC is our main regulator.
I do want to think, I do want to suggest, let our record reflect what Mr. Giesman's comment is, and also reflect that no response was provided based on what Mr. Harbour's statement.
And what I said, which is that we have access to it, and it's very helpful for us, but we are bound by the same confidentiality provisions, which we can't do anything about, or else we wouldn't have access to it, and not having access to it would be a real shame. Okay.
Well, then I would suggest that you not subject the public to the saccharine type of presentation that pretends that the downgrade does not exist.
Oh, I didn't never said it didn't exist. We just didn't say that we whether or not it exists. Not something we can talk about. If you don't mind my saying, it's simply not something we can talk about.
I'd like to make a general statement in response, if I may. Having worked in the industry for 40-plus years with IMPO, IMPO is in place to help nuclear plants achieve or excellence, not just minimum standards. And whether the rating is a high rating or a lower rating, to most employees I've been working with and have interviewed here at the station, the number's not what's important. What's important is an outside agency giving you a very stringent review against the best in the industry to tell you where your strengths are and where your weaknesses are. Your strengths, you appreciate that, and others come visit you to learn from your strengths. Your weaknesses are things for you to work on. That's what's important about IMPO. Again, the rating, in my impression, is not that important to most employees, but the fact that you are recognized for your strengths and you have the opportunity to work on your weaknesses.
Well, I can tell you that to the management of the company, the number is quite important, and to the regulatory community, the number is quite important. When I was a state regulator, we forced access to the INPO ratings by our commission, and it carries considerable significance. I understand that the strictures about confidentiality, I am surprised that the company cannot address or chooses not to address the subject in appropriately general terms.
I do think
that the quality of sugary presentation needs to be taken with a bit of a grain of salt in light of that downgrade.
Additional public comment?
Jane Swanson, San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. I have 5 observations and comments. Most of them are short. I'm glad to know that Ms. Walter says that the current leadership at Diablo Canyon is more supportive of her work in training and supporting safety culture than the prior administration was. That's good news, and I'm sure that she works very hard, and I'm sure that the employees she works with are very sincere about that safety culture. That said, I'm wondering if it's my understanding, and I want to be corrected if I'm wrong, it's my understanding that she does not train the employees of the contractors and subcontractors that work at the plant during times of additional employees. I wish she did, and maybe she does, so I'd like to be enlightened on that at some point. Next comment. Ms. Walter mentioned the money spent at restaurants and motels by workers that come in for fuel outages and such. I just like to mention, I think that's kind of an insult to bring that up before a safety committee. That has nothing to do with anything whatsoever. And I'm not attacking her personally, but it's a theme that comes up with Pacific Gas and Electric Company presentations at NRC meetings, at county supervisor meetings, where the concerns are safety. And they always bring up how much money they put into the tax base for schools and how much money their employees spend. Those are true facts, but they are just not relevant. So a little respect, please. Number three. She accurately explained ALARA as low as reasonably achievable in as pertains to the worker dose of radiation. I just wanted to spell out for the benefit of those watching this on online or live streaming that as low as reasonably achievable radiation doses do not mean safety. That's not safe. Background radiation is not safe, and anything you add to it is statistically a problem. So I just like to clarify that, because I know some people think if it's as low as reasonably achievable that it's fine. No, it's a compromise. If the level of radiation dose had to be safe, then all nuclear facilities would be shut down. There's no such thing. Number four, one of the committee members asked how else PG&E produces electricity besides gas and
that's fossil fuels. A little off our subject, though, but it's just, you know.
Well, it was brought up. Can I make a comment? It's nice. I'm complimenting PG&E. This is positive. So I looked on the PG&E website, and it's their report on such things is dated 2012. But as of 2012, the PG&E website shows it was a 19% of their electricity generation was from sustainable, no-carbon sources such as hydro and geothermal. I'm sure that is motivated by the requirement of the California Energy Commission that all new energy, a certain percentage, be produced by sustainable means. So that's a positive also. And then a really teeny little thing. I can't read those slides over there. Maybe in the future, somebody monitor, make sure they're kind of sharp. I saw they were all fuzzy. They're not there now, but maybe I'm just old. It seemed not sharp, and the background, the lighting was such that the blue thing just. I solved my problem because I found the extra binder there, so I solved my problem, but I don't know. If everybody else can see them, then forget it. But
you're
if other
old.
People can't see it either, it'd be nice for
you're
future.
Not old.
Well, anyway, my eyes are. Thank you.
Thank you. Additional public comment, please. Please announce your name. And
Eric Woodhouse. I'm a resident of Shell Beach.
Welcome.
5 or 6 miles from Diablo Canyon. First of all, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to thank you and the members of the committee for helping to keep us safe. I really do appreciate that. My life probably depends on it. I do have a degree in physics, so I understand a little about nuclear power. Mm-hmm. And I personally believe at this point in time it's the best of other alternative energy sources. I've spent my last 20 years, you can probably tell I've got a British accent, but I've spent my last 20 years in California running the largest cement and concrete company in California. And I just wanted to offer some comments with regard to safety and Professor Lamb's questions earlier about does laxity in one area carry over into others with regard to safety. My experience was that, like many large companies, we had lots of safety rules, books of rules. And when an incident or an accident occurred, it usually was because the individual involved was trying to take a shortcut, which he thought was in the interests of management. And we spent a lot of our time trying to persuade people that taking shortcuts was not in the interests of management. But we weren't always successful in doing that. And I don't have any good answers to that. But I think it's very important that the senior management of PG&E try and install a culture where taking shortcuts is not in the individual's interests or in the company's interests. I mean, clearly, if we had a major incident at Diablo Canyon, it would probably put PG&E out of business. Mm-hmm. And hopefully the senior management realizes that and can convey that to the workers in all of their facilities. Those are my comments, but thank you once again for all the work that you do.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
As the manager there, did you have any programs that were similar to the sort of things that Lynn Walter just described to us? And can you tell us, because this is advanced in the sense that I know that industry commonly did everything like this 50 years ago. What was your experience with that?
Well, I think I had a lot of good ideas this time from the speaker from PG&E. I have to say, I came to one other of these meetings. It was held a couple of years ago. It was one of the embassy suites in San Luis Obispo. And I came away with the impression at that time that PG&E was somewhat arrogant with regard to their responses to some of the issues that came up. I think you were discussing lessons to be learned from Fukushima.
Mm-hmm.
For what it's worth, I don't feel that way this time. I think PG&E has put on a better presentation in terms of their responses. I can't tell you we had anything as sophisticated as was described here today, but I think it's senior management getting out in the field, as we've heard, and really trying to explain what the objectives of the company are, and that safety is the number one objective, because without safety, everything else disappears. Even the profitability of PG&E would disappear in the event of a major incident. So I think it's the senior management trying to get that message across in whatever way they can that will lead to a successful outcome.
What did you find were the barriers to doing that as a senior manager? Besides personality or whatever. Can you speak to that?
Well, the barriers are obviously a one of time and how much time a senior management can devote to that effort. And physically getting people to believe when you say that safety is the number one priority, that you really mean it. They all came back to this, well, this incident occurred because we were doing the company a favor by taking a shortcut. And the question is, how do you get over that? I don't really have the answer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was very helpful. So do we have any additional public comment? Please announce your name.
Sherry Lewis with San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. I couldn't resist the State of the Union remark. And the idea of the safety culture among the workers at PG&E being a very good culture sounds like that's so. But it reminds me of how America is viewed in places like the Middle East. There are some countries where our government is hated, but the people are liked. And so they're happy to have the people there, but they don't trust the government. And by the same token, that could be true of PG&E. The workers are fine, but the corporation might be a little too concerned with the bottom line. So that's just a thought.
Thank you.
Additional public comment? There's been a fair amount of discussion. Lynn Walters, do you have any comments that you'd like to make in response?
I'd like to ask you specifically to address this specific question about training of the of the non-employees.
That's what I wanted to come up and,
go ahead,
and explain
because that was
one.
Specifically.
It's important to know that all of the workers that we bring in get a lot of training, not to the extent of our in-house employees, but they all go. I talked a bit about the dynamic learning activity. They all go through a 2-hour intensive dynamic learning experience in our human performance lab. So we observe them there. We train them until they get it right before they go out in the field. And that's where they learn what our expectations at Diablo Canyon are. These outage workers, most of them, will work at other nuclear plants in the industry, but we're not confident that other nuclear plants will have the same standards as we do. And so we do have them go through this intensive training. you know, as well as they have a lot of computer-based training. They have to, if they're maintenance workers, they have to demonstrate their ability to pack a valve, for example, utilizing the human performance tools that we expect. And they're on crews where we expect our first-line supervisors to observe their work. Many of our employees are returning, and that gives us greater confidence in their ability to meet the standards of our station.
You mean the temporary people are returning from having been here last year or something?
That's correct.
Is that what you mean?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But for the people, we started doing this a couple of outages ago. We are getting people that have never been, number one, to Diablo Canyon, and number two, to a nuclear plant. And so they are identified with stickers on their hard hat that says new to Diablo.
It's an A.
It's not like a scarlet letter, but what it does is it allows us to coach. Everybody on the team sees this person who's new to nuclear or new to Diablo, and we expect them to help them. So that's the culture we're trying to set up.
Interesting.
And can you report about your experiences? Is it a work in progress? Has it been largely successful?
It's been very successful. And we used this on another project at PG&E. It was borrowed from, it's borrowed from other nuclear plants, but we used it very successfully when we built the Gateway project in Antioch. Everybody who was new to the construction site had a new sticker on them, and there was a lot of self coaching amongst the employees. So we kind of adopted that and got the new-to-nuclear sticker on our hat.
Interesting.
Lynn, correct me if I'm wrong on this. On that mock-up, that facility for human performance training, we looked at that as a little over a year ago. My recollection is that one aspect of that training, as they go through this process, is that they begin to accept and understand the penalties of taking a shortcut.
Right.
That if they, as they go through this, and if they try to take a shortcut, it doesn't work.
Right. And they have to redo it.
Is that right?
Is that
correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
It's a flow loop system. They have a procedure, and they're supposed to get product from this side to over here. They have to open and close a number of valves. They have to practice three-way communication. They have to have a procedure reader, and if they skip a step, they will not get the result. So they have to start over.
Yeah, I remember that too. And in fact, I remember that, and of course, that's the stick part. But you'd much better have the carrot part than the stick part.
Yeah, okay, right.
I mean, right. although you'd need to have.
Yeah, they have to redo it, so they're in their longer remediation. Okay, that was.
Thank you.
I'd like to add a couple of comments related to Mr. Woodhouse's statement. So one of the things I wanted to say is, Mr. Woodhouse, your statements are spot on, and just really appreciate your comments about the safety culture, which gets into the management getting out into the field, which I think your insights on some of the workers who might think they're acting in the best interest, taking shortcuts, is something, you know, it's a human nature thing that we would like to say that we're perfect at that, but we're not, and it's something that we continue to work on, and that's about improving our safety culture. So I think your comments were right on, and it's something we continue to work through. Lynn talked about some of our programs to do that. And, the question about the stop when unsure, that Mr. Wardell had mentioned, what's new about that. And it is something that's been around in our lexicon and in our industry for a long time, but it's that getting the management out in the field, talking with the workers, making sure that they understand, hey, we really do want to stop. Well, you don't want us to get it done? Oh, no, this is not right. Let's stop. So, it's something that we continue to work on, and in 2014, we're putting greater emphasis on that. But I think you're spot on in one of those areas of being able to improve human behavior. And so, we'll continue to focus on that. So I just really appreciate your comments, and let you know that we've got more to do, and we're going to continue to work on that.
Any other comments from the committee members?
At this point, we're going to move to concluding remarks, discussion by committee members of any future DCISD activities. We did already develop our agenda for future fact-finding and public meetings, but I'd ask for any concluding remarks.
I have three.
Peter?
Mr. Chairman, may I make three concluding remarks? One, I am very appreciative of Mr. Kerry Harbour's commitment to file a supplemental response to the committee's annual report, specifically to the second recommendation, to make it more responsive. Thank you. Second remark is I personally appreciate a great deal that the senior policy nuclear advisor from the Energy Commission, Ms. Joan Waters, and the Chief of Staff of the Chairman of the Energy Commission, Mr. Kevin Barker, had taken time from their very busy schedule to come down to San Luis Obispo to attend 2 full days of committee meeting, and that's a long way from Sacramento, and thank you. And then the third remark would be my personal recognition and appreciation of a group of individuals, specifically Ms. Rochelle Becker, the Executive Director of the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility, and Mr. John Giesman, Esquire, representing the Alliance, and then Ms. Jane Swanson and Ms. Shirley Lewis from the Mother for Peace. I think they not only provide a healthy dose of skepticism to this proceeding, and I think it's clear from their participation that they have done their homework before they participate in this proceeding, and they brought the issue of significant importance to their organization to the committee's attention. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Bob?
I just one last thing to say about Pete, because Pete Bettison supported our committee for quite a while. It's been stellar, and I want to thank you. He's turning over the reins now, but it shouldn't go unspoken that it's been stellar, and we really appreciate it. And by the way, it's not just here what you see, but we go out on the fact findings, you know, and Pete's the one that makes sure that things work for us. And it wouldn't, and it doesn't work without somebody that's doing that. And so I want to thank you not only that, but for your friendship. It's really been very, very strong. Thanks.
Good. And at this point, I'll also add just a few concluding remarks. I also want to thank the people who have made this meeting successful, and I'll start with Kerry Harbour. I should mention I've known Kerry Harbour for a very long time. He graduated with my very first doctoral student, Richard Fox, from UC Santa Barbara, so it's been a real pleasure to follow him from when he was a wet behind the ears young engineer to see where he's gotten to today. And I got to say it gives one satisfaction to see people develop and become professionals as Kerry has. I also want to thank Pete Bettison for his service to the committee, and to welcome and to say we really look forward to working with Maureen Zawalek also. We would not be able to do our work if it weren't and have it available to people both to stream on the web and also archived and available to view after our meetings if it weren't for the excellent work by AGP Video, and we thank them. And then finally, as the other members have noted, this is a public meeting. We appreciate very much the participation of all of the members of the public, and it does have a substantive impact on the issues that we look at. If I were to look at our open items list as we did this time, I would say that at least half of the items or more that we end up focusing on emerge from comments made by the public during the course of our public meetings that are recorded in our minutes and then entered into action. And so in this sense, hopefully, we remain appropriately responsive to input from the public.
And Mr. Chairman, may I ask for your forbearance for one final comment?
Yes, please.
To Mr. Kerry Harbour. Kerry, in my native tongue, I could not tell the difference between Gary and Kerry. Therefore, I repeatedly mispronounce your name. My sincere apology.
Thank you. So, with these concluding remarks, I believe that we have no additional business to conduct.
If council concurs with that.
That's correct, because you already have all of your future site visits and study sessions and such have been determined yesterday.
Excellent. In that case, it is time for us now to adjourn this 72nd public meeting of the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee. Thank you, everyone.